Hey, Marketplace listeners, you know, around here, we like to think you're never too young to learn about the economy and financial basics. That's why we're bringing the Million Bazillion Live Tour to school to teach important lessons about budgeting, investing, saving, and more. It's all the fun of the podcast, but now live, immersive, and interactive. Special thanks to our tour partner, Greenlight, the debit card and money app for kids and teens. Learn more about Greenlight at greenlight.com/million. That is greenlight.com/million. Well, we know what Janet Yellen's thinking now, don't we? From American Public Media, this is Marketplace. In Los Angeles, I'm Kai Rizdahl. Friday, December the 16th. This one is great to have you with us, everybody, as always. Friday on a Fed week doesn't get any better than that, does it? Well, it does, but, you know, not in daily business journalism. David Gura is at Bloomberg. Catherine Rampell is at the Washington Post. They are both in our studios in New York to wrap up the 5 days going by. Hey, everybody.
Hey, Kai.
Hey, Kai.
Catherine, first question goes to you. Give me your quick gut pass at Chair Yellen and what she had to say about the American economy this week.
Well, she said it was good and that it was time to raise rates, that we will be raising rates more often than expected next year. But she also cautioned that there was a, quote, I think, cloud of uncertainty hovering over the economy and what the President-elect Trump will do. So that seems optimistic and yet cautious.
Well, we're right. So, David, the best part of me for this whole thing was when she said, talking to the President-elect and to Congress, I don't know that fiscal policy, that is to say government spending changes, are what we need right now.
Yeah, I thought that was a remarkable moment when she allowed that. I think going into the press conference, a lot of people were wondering the degree to which she would comment on what Donald Trump has proposed, what House Republicans say they're going to get through here, these tax cuts, big infrastructure spending. Should she approach this rate decision? Should she and her colleagues approach that decision? Not thinking about that because we haven't really seen much meat on the bones yet. And the point she made was, look at where employment is right now, unemployment at 4.6%. Maybe this isn't the right time to spend so much money on infrastructure. We have some insight into what she and her colleagues were thinking at that meeting this week.
What happens, Catherine, if government stimulus does go ahead and yet the economy is already at 4.6%? I mean, it's inflationary and all of that jazz.
Well, we'll probably have a nice little boost to growth in the near term. Yep. In the longer term, it's somewhat dangerous. It means that if and when, well, I should say when, we have a recession, there won't be that much powder left in the keg. We will be basically causing the economy, or potentially causing the economy, I should say, to overheat right now because we do have very low unemployment. And it's not clear that this is what the economy needs at this point, not only because we are so close to full employment, but because, again, you want to have some measures left, some Keynesian stimulus left for when it's actually necessary.
David, let me ask you a sort of macroist question here. The dollar has been on a tear. Rates are going up here, so people are plowing into the dollar. That, in theory, and again, you know, this is all sort of in the out years now with the Trump economy, could put a little hitch in his giddy up, if you will, economically, and what he wants to get done.
Yeah, a great kind of unanswered question at that news conference as well was what's going to happen to the Federal Reserve. Janet Yellen's term ends in 2018, I believe, and I think there could be five or six vacancies on the Fed when you look at governors and other positions that Donald Trump has the potential to fill there. So she didn't address that uncertainty. She didn't address the uncertainty about what's going to happen with trade. You know, if there were new tariffs, that could have a huge effect, huge drag on the economy. She didn't wade into those waters as well. Yeah, you look at the dollar, incredibly strong. You look at the euro weakening to a level that I don't think we'd seen since 2003.
I'm calling it now, by the way.
This week.
Parity is coming back. Dollar-euro parity
is
coming back.
Parity. We're on parity.
I think we should all go to Europe and just buy everything that's not nailed down.
That's right. Weekly wrap from London. I love it.
There's
all sorts of trouble with the Chinese currency as well. I mean, it's hard to remember low those many months ago, but January and February of this year, so much trouble with the reserves in China, and it seems like we're headed right back for that again.
I don't want to put too much emphasis on the markets, Catherine, but I do feel obliged just because he mentioned it, the president-elect did, in that meeting he had with the tech CEOs on, I guess, Wednesday. You know, part of the footage that got passed around before the cameras got ushered out was him saying, well, they're talking about the bounce, and I'm grateful for the bounce, and I love the bounce, right? And it was him talking about the stock market rally that has happened, in all fairness, since Election Day. People keep asking me as I go out on the streets and you know, chit-chat with folks. Well, how much credit does Donald Trump deserve for the stock market rally? And so the question now gets put to you live on the radio.
Well, far be it from me to try to explain those animal spirits.
Yeah.
I will say that if you talk with, big Wall Street economists, for example, they will acknowledge that there's some optimism about the value of tax breaks, for example, and the fact that there could be repatriation of some profits that are overseas, and that, you know, could help the bottom lines of some of these big publicly traded companies. So I don't want to discount that. But on the other hand, again, I try to be very cautious about interpreting those animal spirits.
Fair enough. David,
you're looking for for rainbows in that cloud of uncertainty. And a lot of people will say also that, you know, he's talked about scaling back regulations, if not ripping them up as a whole. And so if you believe what the banks are saying, that they're burdened by the regulations we've seen here in the last 5-6 years, then maybe there is a case there to be made. Again, there could be a case not to be made as well. We don't know what he's going to do yet. Yeah. But if regulation disappears, that could potentially be good for the banks.
David Gura and Catherine Rempel in our New York bureau on a chilly, chilly Friday in New York City.
Very cool.
Thanks, you too.
Thanks, guys.
All right, have a good weekend. On Wall Street today, we'll call it a break in that bounce. We'll have the details when we do the numbers. All right, so I was talking big picture with Gura there and the dollar for a minute. Here is a really big picture story. It's about America in the global economy, specifically American debt in that economy. According to new data out from the Treasury Department, China sold off more than $41 billion worth of U.S. government debt in October. And oh, hey, look, despite what everybody had been saying, the sky is not falling. Marketplace's Amy Scott explains.
China has been, or had been, the single biggest holder of U.S. treasuries for most of the past decade, and with that came the fear of what might happen if China decided to sell off that debt.
And if it had to be done quickly, then the value of all treasury bonds could fall rather quickly as well.
Guy Leba is chief fixed income strategist with Janney Montgomery Scott. When bond prices fall, interest rates go up, and that could slow down the U.S. economy. The thing is, Leba says, China has been unloading U.S. treasuries for about 18 months now.
The impact has been very gradual and measured over time, so you can never point to a single day and say, hey, China caused bonds to sell off.
So why has China been selling? Ann Lee, author of What the U.S. Can Learn from China, says partly to raise dollars in order to buy its own currency, to prop up the value. Lee says despite President-elect Trump's claims that China has been devaluing the yuan to keep its exports cheap.
That hasn't been the case for years now. These days, China's actually been trying to keep its currency elevated.
If China keeps up or speeds up the sell-off, there is a risk that could push up interest rates. But Brian Setzer, a senior fellow with the Council on Foreign Relations, downplays that risk.
I think what we've learned is that Chinese sales are only one factor, and probably not the dominant factor, that drives U.S. Treasury yields.
What matters far more, he says, is what our own central bank decides to do and the policy changes that will come with the Trump administration. I'm Amy Scott for Marketplace.
President Obama gave his annual end of the year I'm about to go on vacation press conference today, in which he repeated his warnings to Russia about cyber attacks. The actual quote was, "Don't do this to us because we can do stuff to you." As to what that stuff is, well, the president said that is still being discussed, but it's worth a mention here that the United States and the European Union actually have stiff economic sanctions on Russia in place already from back in 2014 when Moscow annexed Crimea. So Marketplace's Adam Allington brings us up to date on the U.S.-Russian sanctions relationship and what other responses might be available.
There's lots of different ways to sanction another country. As it stands, the U.S. still has travel bans and asset freezes for nearly 150 of Putin's closest allies. That's on top of sanctions isolating specific sectors of Russia's shrinking economy, including energy, banking, and defense. But are those sanctions working?
There's a robust case to say that they have had an economic effect.
Elizabeth Rosenberg is a senior fellow at the Center for A New American Security, as well as a former sanctions advisor at the Treasury Department. She says the sanctions are being felt in particular by the Russian military.
The inaccessibility of certain defense technologies has had an effect that will be seen more in the medium to long term on their military modernization plans.
Rosenberg says the United States can also deploy its own cyber attacks on Russia, and likely will, and there's still room to expand economic sanctions even further. But dealing a crippling blow to the Russian economy might not be the aim at this point.
The value of sanctions is really in sending a signal.
Rob Morgus is a policy analyst with the New America Foundation's Cybersecurity Initiative.
Oftentimes, the only time that sanctions are really truly effective is when they are sanctions pointed at an entire country.
And at this point, Morgus says blanket sanctions, like those imposed on Cuba, would be viewed as too punitive, especially considering President-elect Trump has already rejected the CIA's evidence of Russian influence as ridiculous. I'm Adam Allington for Marketplace.
Presidential campaigns, as we all know, are replete with promises. And whoever wins, Republican or Democrat, the winners spend a lot of time trying to keep them. With that in mind, then, we turn to President-elect Trump, who pledged sweeping political and economic changes in this country during the campaign. This is the latest installment of a recurring series we're calling The Big Promise. And we've got no idea, obviously, whether President-elect Trump is going to be able to deliver on those promises, but we can explore what it's going to take for him to try. Today, candidate Trump's promise to bring back American steel jobs. Marketplace's Kimberly Adams visited a steel town in southwest Illinois.
The United Steelworkers Union Hall in Granite City, Illinois, like the steel industry here, has been around for decades. The wooden stairs creak, and the building is full of old posters and memorabilia. Dan Simmons, president of Steelworkers Local 1899, points out an old notice board he found.
American Alliance of Iron, Steel, and Tin Workers, which I believe is 1930-something. Wow. This was down in the basement.
A couple of streets away is the steel mill. It's so big, it feels like a city unto itself. Mountains of raw materials, weathered buildings that stretch for blocks, rows of parking spaces that once were full of cars, but not right now.
It looks like a ghost town.
That's because hundreds of steel workers here have been laid off in recent years.
But actually, we have currently about 437 members working. And at a brief time, those people weren't working. And then you've seen tumbleweeds going through the plant. It's pretty eerie.
President-elect Trump's promises to renegotiate trade deals and bring back manufacturing jobs resonated in steel towns. Michael Hicks is the director of the Center for Business and Economic Research at Ball State University.
The impact that's felt by even a small disturbance in international trade is very heavy in those communities, but it goes almost unnoticed by the rest of the country.
The union says for every lost steel job in Granite City, seven other jobs are affected. Materials suppliers, the scrap yard, even the donut shop and a renovated gas station across from the mill, they're all feeling the hit. And laid-off steel workers are hard-pressed to find other jobs that pay even half of what their old jobs did. David Holzman lost his job in January after 26 years.
Now, I got hopes for Trump. He's got this infrastructure plan going on, you know, make it in America, this stuff. And I hope he does. I hope he delivers on his promises.
Holzman is skeptical, though. He voted for Hillary Clinton. His union backed her, too. But many of his co-workers latched on to Trump's message. They broke with the United Steelworkers and supported the Republican candidate. I talked to laid-off workers gathering just before a union meeting on the day Trump announced a deal to preserve some jobs at Carrier in Indiana. Trump's supporters, like Scott Naylor, felt validated. But he's not expecting the same for every industry.
I look for it to be more of a policy change instead of him actually getting involved with it personally. He's not going to have the time to do that.
Clinton supporter David Holzman was not impressed.
I think it was a publicity stunt. I'm glad it worked, but he's going to have to do it a whole bunch more times before I'm going to vote for him next time.
And steel workers like Holzman may get their jobs back anyway. That's thanks to an ongoing crackdown on international steel dumping. Again, Dan Simmons, the local union president.
We see the steel prices already increase, and along with that, you're seeing the demand starting to pick up a little bit. So the normal order of business and demand is going to get us back to work.
In fact, just this week, U.S. Steel said it will bring back more than 200 jobs at the Granite City site by mid-February. Michael Hicks at Ball State says the old days won't be coming back with them, because trade is only part of the story. There's automation, increased efficiency.
You could see an uptick in steel jobs. We're just not going to return to the 30,000 or 40,000 person steel towns of Gary, Indiana, or Pittsburgh that we saw 50 or 60 years ago. Those days have passed, and there's no public policy that can bring them back.
Political promises can only go so far. In Granite City, Illinois, I'm Kimberly Adams for Marketplace.
Coming up.
Anything that is made by a human automatically has biases built into them. It's just who we are.
But who does Facebook think you are? First, though, let's do the numbers. The Dow Industrial is off 8 points today, less than a tenth percent, 19,843 on the blue chips. The NASDAQ down 19 points, a third percent, 5,437 there. The S&P 500 declined 3 points, about a tenth percent. 22 and 58. For the week, the Dow up 86 points, 0.4%. The NASDAQ down 7 points, about a 10%. The S&P 500 down as well, a point, basically unchanged for the week. Tomorrow is Super Saturday, the last full Saturday shopping day before Christmas. Some 156 million holiday buyers, including moi, are going to hit the nation's stores in search of discounts. And yet, Macy's off 0.6% today, 6.6% rather. Target down 0.25%. On the subject of shopping, credit card companies are expected to raise the interest rates they charge consumers by 0.25% within the next two billing cycles. Thanks, Yellen. You're listening to Marketplace.
Looking for the highest interest rate on your cash? At Public.com, you can earn 5.1% APY with a high-yield cash account. And while we can't say it's officially the highest interest rate out there, we can say this. It's a higher rate than Robinhood, a higher rate than SoFi, a higher rate than Marcus, a higher rate than Wealthfront, frankly, a higher rate than Capital One, a higher rate than Ally, a higher rate than Barclays, a way higher rate than Bank of America and Chase, a higher rate than Citi, Wells Fargo, Discover, and it's a higher rate than American Express, too. So if you want to start earning 5.1% APY on your cash, check out public.com. We can't say it's the highest interest rate, but it's pretty darn up there. This is paid for by Public Investing. 5.1% APY as of March 26, 2024, and is subject to change. A high-yield cash account is a secondary brokerage account with Public Investing, member FINRA/SIPC. Funds from this account are automatically deposited into partner banks where they earn a variable interest and are eligible for FDIC insurance. Neither Public Investing nor any of its affiliates is a bank. U.S. only. Learn more at public.com/disclosure/high-yield-account.
This is Marketplace. I'm Kai Rizdahl. There are almost 2 billion people worldwide who are on Facebook, so the odds are pretty good that you are one of them. And on your profile, there's tons of your personal data, stuff like where you live and if you're in a relationship, where you work, and all the different stuff you like. And with all that information, Facebook could know more about you than maybe even you do. Sue Halpern is a writer at the New York Review of Books. Her most recent article is called They Have Right Now Another You. Sue, welcome to the program.
It's good to be here, Kai.
You got into the data that Facebook uses to describe you to, I guess, to its advertisers and to its algorithms. What did you find out about what Facebook thinks of you?
Facebook thinks I really like gummy bears, flight attendants, a wrestler named The Edge, and it also decided that I liked a Japanese duo named Puffy Emmy Yummy.
Well, now, have you been, like, clicking on gummy bear sites? I mean, how does it gather this, what it thinks is you?
That's a really good question, and I wish I knew, but the algorithms that Facebook uses are proprietary and secret, and so I don't think I'll ever know.
Here's the thing, though, and this is sort of the root of this piece. Facebook makes, one could say, wild and misleading assumptions about you, and then uses that to sell you, basically, and make boodles and boodles of money.
That's right. So where we think, oh, they're looking at what we like and who we are and who our friends are, and they're using that to sell us stuff that we want, which in some sense is probably true. But really what they're doing is compiling some kind of profile of you that they're selling to advertisers and making a bundle of money. I think last year was something like $4 billion. So it's in their best interest to make you look really interesting to their advertisers.
Yeah. There's a detour in this piece, or maybe sort of a secondary through line here about how, for all that we talk about data in this economy and algorithms and how that drives it, how it drives a lot of what happens, algorithms and data are not neutral.
We tend to think of them in the same way that we think of math, 1, 2, 3, 4. They're not Republican, they're not Democrat, but an algorithm is basically just a set of instructions that are given to a computer. Anything that is made by a human automatically has biases built into them. It's just who we are.
Give me the just to put an example on this one. Give me the computer judging the beauty pageant example.
So some guys had this brilliant idea that a computer could decide who are the most beautiful women in the world. And in order to train the computer to make this calculation, they fed it photographs of women they considered to be beautiful. And the women that they considered to be beautiful, to a large extent, turned out to be Caucasian. And so, shockingly, when the computer determined who the most beautiful women in the world were, they were almost to a person white women.
So if data and algorithms are skewed by human input, as they are, and if, as you quote, Facebook founder Mark Zuckerberg is saying here, that privacy is no longer a social norm, where do we go with this in an era where, honestly, to get by in this economy, you kind of have to be online?
I think that one thing that we can do is be really, really vigilant and careful about what information we hand over. That starts with, you know, very simple things. Even on your Facebook profile, you don't have to say that you're in a relationship. You don't have to tell them where you live. All those things may seem really minimal and throwaway. But when they're taken in with lots of other pieces of data, it means that you can be identified very easily and, as a consequence, give up your privacy without ever really thinking that you've done anything.
Sue Halpern is a writer. She's a fellow at Middlebury College up in Vermont, and she is also the author of a piece in the New York Review of Books, most recently called They Have Right Now, Another You, about data and privacy and how we get by in this economy. Sue, thanks very much.
Thank you, Kai.
Christmas gifts are usually nowadays about kids. Ads for toys and video games and electronics are everywhere this time of year. Back in the 50s and 60s, though, advertisers geared their work toward grown-ups. Design historian Sarah Archer explores Christmas gift-giving in post-war America in her book. It's called Mid-Century Christmas. It is also today's installment of our series Holidays, brought to you by
Imagination.
Wonderful products.
Brought to you by...
Before Christmas was reconceived as a family-friendly holiday that centered around children, gifts tended to run to adult tastes for things like books, clothes, fine food, jewelry, and other keepsakes. But post-war grown-ups got to play house just like their kids in the 1950s and 60s, when it seemed that everything from a new stove to a washer-dryer to a sleek red typewriter, at least as far as advertisers were concerned, was as exciting and fun as a new toy. Santa Claus himself, or more specifically his office workflow, advertised the new IBM dictaphone in a 1966 print ad. With this 28-ounce unit, Santa says, I don't have to trust important things to memory, like who gets a football and who gets a diamond necklace. Other companies relied on the lure of color to sell evergreen products like furniture and appliances. The General Telephone System told consumers to quote-unquote give color in a December 1957 print ad, in which a bright red Model 500 telephone is held up as the perfect holiday gift. Throughout the 1950s and 60s, GE advertised its array of products for both inside and outside the home. From portable hair dryers and television sets in fashionable colors to waffle irons and strings of electric lights for holiday decor. Though the company was strongly associated with particular kinds of goods, particularly light bulbs, GE made an effort in its advertising to promote the ideas of technology and newness as its own signature selling point, knowing that gadgets of any particular holiday season would be nearly obsolete a few years later. In one double-page ad from the mid-1960s promoting portable TVs, the tagline read, "Progress is our most important product."
That was Sarah Archer. She is the author of the book Mid-Century Christmas. This final note on the way out today, too, actually, both about millennials. First of all, and this is totally serious, the Wall Street Journal reports that consumer products giant Procter & Gamble is launching a new ad campaign aimed at getting millennials to use fabric softener. That new generation of shoppers apparently doesn't have any idea what fabric softener does. Me neither, come to think of it. Downy sales, just for some context here, off 26% the past 8 years. Also, NASA, the space agency, is going to start using GIFs on its social media accounts to get millennials excited about space, which I think is cool. Also, yes, I did say GIFs. I did it just to start a Twitter fight. You realize that, right, GIFs? All right, the Dow off 8 points today, less than a 10%. NASDAQ down 19 points, 0.3%. The S&P 500 off 3 points, 0.1%. Our music was composed by BJ Lederman. Marketplace is produced by Nancy Fargali. Star Nieves is the executive producer. Deborah Clark is the senior vice president and general manager around here. I'm Kai Rizdahl. We'll see you on Monday, everybody. Have a good weekend. This is APM.
The world can be a confusing place for kids, and finding the words to explain it all can be tricky, too. Introducing Million Bazillion, a Webby-winning podcast from Marketplace that takes your kids on exciting adventures to answer the awkward and complex questions they have about money. Each week, we tackle hard-hitting inquiries from kid listeners like,
"What is a college account and how does it work?
I want to know what unions are and what they are for.
Why does the U.S. have so much gold in Fort Knox and what do they use it for?"
Help your kids understand how money fits into the world around us. Listen to Million Bazillion wherever you get your podcasts.